My name is George Prout, and on behalf of the Plum Club, I'll be your host to 5 key insights into the inner workings of the lab-grown phenomenon. For the next 20 minutes, I'll be exploring the world of lab-grown diamonds, and I'll take you through the current state of affairs on the supply side, both globally as well as closer to home. And I'll also drill down to what appears to be happening on the consumer side. I'll then take you through 5 key insights that will help explain what's happening and perhaps provide a sense of near and medium-term future trends. The lab-grown phenomenon is now clearly the most significant disruptor in the diamond business for the current generation. How this occurred and what comes next are important for any strategist to understand as he or she contemplates the future. It is my hope that you will come away from this podcast with knowledge and actionable plans that will help you to navigate what may now be a very different set of challenges in the diamond jewelry business. Now, for the purposes of this discussion, let's limit our analysis primarily to CVD, the chemical vapor deposition side of the lab-grown business. What's happening on the HPHT side is also interesting. But for now, since HPHT is the primary method for growing melee sizes, let's stay out of those weeds. From a global perspective, consider the fact that as of early 2023, there are about 7,300 CVD reactors devoted to growing gemstone-quality diamonds, allocated internationally to individual growers as follows. 4 major growers are in China, with a total of approximately 1,400 machines. 6 are in India, totaling approximately 5,000 machines. 3 are in the U.S., with about 500 machines. And 2 are in Israel, with about 400 machines. There are others, of course, but none are large enough to move the needle. I have seen several current estimates showing that about 75% of global lab-grown CVD production is coming from China and India. But don't forget, LVMH made a $90 million investment in Lusix, one of the 2 Israeli growers, just last year. This will definitely make Israel a more important player. And I'll add parenthetically that it will also shake up the luxury products vertical when lab-grown diamonds start adorning products in the LVMH family of brands. Also, India's current largest CVD grower is about to launch a significant number of new machines, which is likely to have a substantial impact on global market share. Now, as I mentioned, there are some smaller growers, and I've heard anecdotally that the cost per machine has dropped from about $300,000 in 2019 to about $100,000 today, which will serve to reduce the barrier to entry. So, don't be surprised if both the total number of growers as well as the number of machines continues to expand. This will all happen based on equilibrium points where supply meets demand. So, what's happening on the demand side? Well, globally, lab-grown diamond jewelry sales climbed to over $12 billion in 2022. And I've seen multiple forecasts from sources like Paul Zimnisky, a noted authority who publishes a monthly review of diamond production that is viewed with great reference by the sightholder community, placing lab-grown diamond jewelry sales over $50 billion by the year 2030. Domestically, lab-grown diamond jewelry has grown from 3% share in 2020 to a 5% share in 2021, and now a 10% share in 2022. But these numbers only tell part of the story. The Knot reports that for their respondents, more than 1/3 of engagement rings purchased last year had a lab-grown center stone. And larger pools of domestic consumer data put the bridal share for lab at 30% for most of 2022 and closer to 40% last December. Lab-grown diamond fashion sales significantly lag bridal. But looking at the majors, we see a rapidly expanding growth track from 4% in 2021 to 11% in 2022. And most tellingly, in sales in the category of solitaire rings, earrings, and pendants, the majors appear to now be exceeding 40% in lab-grown diamonds. And while the majors are seeing significant increases in demand, the independent vertical is shifting to lab at a breathtaking pace. According to an in-store survey in late 2022, 76% of independent jewelers sold lab, and of those who had not yet embraced lab-grown diamonds, about half were considering doing so in the near future. I'll add that I have personal experience with about 400 stores carrying lab-grown diamond jewelry in 2022. And for many of those stores, lab has become almost a runaway freight train, to the extent that many tell me that their staffs are now taking the consumer to lab right away, sadly bypassing the mined option completely. In considering these numbers, recognize that American consumer adoption of lab has taken place at a far more rapid rate than the rest of the world. But as more and more consumers achieve middle-class status in both India and China, studies by prominent news sources in both countries predict that lab-grown diamond adoption rates in both are ready to explode, to the extent that while LGD production will certainly continue to increase, those increases may be more than offset by Asian consumers who want to buy lab. And multiple attendees selling lab at the Vicenza show in January told me that many prominent European retailers are starting to plan lab-grown diamond jewelry tests, almost perfectly emulating the interest that American retailers were showing 24 months ago. So we can reasonably expect European demand to track in a manner similar to the U.S. market, although with generally smaller sizes creating the most demand. In summary, a significant number of American retailers are selling lab to a substantial number of consumers, and these numbers are growing exponentially. Yet over the past 5 years, the vast majority of thought leaders in the diamond jewelry business predicted that the scenario we're now seeing would never occur. Which causes me to ask, how did so many smart people get lab-grown diamonds so completely wrong? Here are 5 insights that may provide an answer to those questions. Insight number 1, how Moore's Law is now repositioning diamond products in the luxury marketplace. The downward trajectory in lab prices has caused nearly everyone to be concerned about whether consumers would be happy buying a luxury item that was declining in value. And it is absolutely the case that lab-grown diamond prices are on a downward spiral. Imagine, in 2016, a 1-carat lab-grown diamond was about 10% less expensive than a 1-carat mined diamond. Today, that difference in price can be as much as 90%. But our preoccupation with the reduction in prices actually caused us to miss an important fact, a scenario that is best understood by contemplating a fundamental principle in the production of technologically driven prices called Moore's Law. Moore's Law was a prediction made in the late 1960s by then Intel CEO Gordon Moore that the density of transistors on a microchip would double every 2 years, thereby doubling the chip's computing power. The audacity of Moore's conjecture was breathtaking, but as things turned out, he was absolutely right. And as the computing power of these chips repeatedly doubled, something extraordinary happened to the value that could be delivered to consumers shopping in the electronics vertical. Think of the discretionary spend that has been almost magnetically attracted to consumer electronics over the past 50 years, much of it at the expense of the jewelry business. Games, tablets, smartphones, laptops, all variety of electronic gadgets became more and more powerful and more enticing to own as Moore's Law took the perceived value of these items up an exponential curve. To illustrate, I can specifically remember a terrifying focus group study that De Beers performed with 8th-grade girls in the early 2000s, offering them a choice between an iPod and a pair of half-carat total weight diamond stud earrings. As I recall, 85% of the girls chose the iPod, a fact that at the time caused me to wonder if the diamond jewelry industry would last long enough for me to successfully retire. And during the 20 years since, the electronics you could buy at the $400 price point simply got cooler and cooler, while the diamond studs actually went up in price, offering even less value per dollar spent. But now, thanks to advances in technology, the diamond industry will at last have Moore's Law as an ally, and the value per dollar spent in our luxury vertical will now grow exponentially as a result. By putting diamonds on the Moore's Law curve, we are now seeing the upward trajectory in perceived value that accompanies the technologically driven reduction in price. Declining lab prices will open entirely new vistas for fashion-conscious women with upscale tastes. We have been terribly concerned about losing the value advantage that dimes have historically had as a store of value, something that apparently doesn't mean anything to the vast majority of today's consumers, while missing the incredible benefit we as an industry will obtain when the kinds of dime and jewelry designs that adorned starlets like Elizabeth Taylor a generation ago suddenly become an option for modern luxury appetites. The massive diamond stud earrings in the 2 to 6 carat total weight range that were suddenly flying off the shelves this past December offer testimony to the coming revolution in the way that consumers will wear and purchase diamond jewelry, all resulting from the wonderful effects of Moore's Law. Next, let's consider insight number 2, how the capacity for a diamond to be a store of value is losing its relevance. For centuries, part of the allure of diamonds lay in the fact that they represented a highly portable store of value. And during times of political upheaval, this demonstrated capacity played out over and over again as wealthy individuals converted their household goods into diamonds and transported them to safety. And one need look no further than the crown jewels of England to recognize that extraordinary wealth and power could be communicated by the possession of diamond jewelry. So we should not be surprised that as middle class in Europe and America came of age, they too would see diamonds as a transgenerational source of wealth conveyance. But I submit that during the past 75 years of American global hegemony, there have been relatively limited episodes of political unrest, diminishing the allure of the diamond as a store of wealth. And the deeply resonating events of political upheaval during the first half of the last century have now, for the most part, been lost in the mist of living memory. It's also important to recognize that a significant shift in societal attitudes has brought about some fundamental changes in the consumption habits of American consumers, which can be illustrated by considering something called the Stanford Marshmallow Test. In 1969, a group of Stanford psychologists tested 600 kindergartners by leaving them individually in a room seated at a desk on which a plate plus one marshmallow had been placed. The children were told that if they wished, they could eat the marshmallow immediately, but if they waited to eat the first marshmallow for 20 minutes, they would be given a second marshmallow. These children have now been tracked throughout their subsequent lives, and unsurprisingly, the ones who waited for the second marshmallow have generally led more happy, productive lives by every metric. I submit that during the past 54 years, we have inadvertently created a society consisting almost exclusively of first marshmallow eaters, as borne out by subsequent marshmallow tests in subsequent decades, demonstrating a shift that augurs well for lab-grown diamond consumer adoption, since only a second marshmallow eater would willingly wear a much smaller diamond, waiting decades for it to appreciate in value. The fact that today's 28-year-old is so overwhelmed by a single desire to wear a glacier on her finger that she lacks the discipline necessary to accept a smaller stone demonstrates the evident psychographic shift in consumer preferences and attitudes that sadly diminishes the importance of the diamond as an investment. Now on to insight number 3, how the advent of lab-grown diamonds in larger sizes, high colors, and high clarities is changing the way that consumers think about diamonds and diamond jewelry. During the past several years, I've had many discussions with experts at every level of the diamond supply chain about how the decline in lab-grown diamond prices will ultimately devastate average unit retails, with a catastrophic reduction in both revenues and gross profit for jewelry stores. A catalyst for these discussions is often an incapacity to understand that the lab-grown diamond sector behaves very, very differently from the mine sector. As just one example, note that in 2022, nearly one quarter of all lab-grown diamond searches performed on internet retailing websites hosted by GemFind, a significant provider of web services in the independent vertical, were for diamonds of 3 carats or more. And nearly one half of lab-grown diamond searches were for VS Clarity, and 3/4 of all searches for lab-grown diamonds were for colors in the DEF range. It will come as no surprise that the vast majority of mined diamond searches on retailer websites hosted by GemFind were for sizes, colors, and clarity ranges that were far below the lab group. And we also see evidence from sales data that clearly show that as lab prices declined last year, intrinsic characteristics of lab was causing consumers to step up to a bigger, prettier diamond. And this isn't just happening in independent jewelry stores. We're hearing from the majors that the average unit retail of lab-grown diamond engagement rings is actually much higher than their average unit retail for mined diamonds. And consumer research from The Knot indicates that over 1/3 of consumers will spend at least 25% over their budget if they can purchase a lab-grown diamond that's at least twice as large as its mined alternative. These facts lead to key insight number 4, how democratizing diamonds is creating new audiences due to increased accessibility. Many of us can recall how back in the late 70s and early 80s, Shane Decker virtually invented his career as a jewelry store sales trainer with one key innovation. Shane taught the sales associates to make sure that every woman who entered the store had an opportunity to try on a 1-carat diamond. Why a 1-carat? For starters, the 1-carat diamond represented at the time a club that middle-class female consumers wanted to join. And for their boyfriends and husbands, the capacity to purchase a diamond of that size represented an economic threshold of accomplishment. But just as important, diamonds of 1 carat or more are simply more impressive and more beautiful than smaller stones. In this case, size really does matter, and Shane had identified the killer training application that allowed independent store owners to suddenly attain much higher levels of revenue success. Now, unfortunately, not everyone could afford a 1 carat, so the industry and its designers have come up with a wide range of styling devices to augment the appearance of diamonds in a setting. Notably, in the late 90s, new engagement ring designs featuring halos launched a revolution in consumer preference, creating a key styling attribute that dominated engagement ring styling for nearly 2 subsequent decades. Simultaneously, Indian and Chinese manufacturers devised all manner of composites, which were simply smaller diamonds clustered together in ever more complex ways to create the illusion of a much larger single center stone. So now, consider the impact when it becomes no longer necessary to artificially create the illusion of a 1-carat diamond, or to surround a smaller center stone with melee, again to increase its apparent size. And to accomplish this with an FVS ideal cut 1-carat at a cost of less than $500. Suddenly, couples whose economic circumstance, both here in the States as well as in China, India, and elsewhere, can now have access to something that Shane Decker and the many sales associates he trained thought was a size of diamond that could actually hit the visual sweet spot, thereby creating an entire world full of new diamond consumers whose initial indoctrination through an engagement ring will naturally be followed by a lifelong interest in studs, bracelets, and other fashion items. And just as the democratization of diamonds through larger stones at accessible price points will create a vast new set of hungry consumers around the globe, key insight number 5 lies in the fact that lab-grown diamonds become increasingly perceived as a luxury product in the U.S. We will see inevitable evolutions in both the size of diamonds that American consumers want to purchase, as well as the styling and the mountings they wish to use for setting those much larger diamonds. We're already seeing this phenomenon in diamond basics, like monster diamond studs in 4 to 6 carat total weight ranges, as well as 5 to 15 carat total weight bracelets and 10 to 30 carat Rivieras. But it's also becoming increasingly clear that the next critical step in maximizing diamond sales, especially diamond ring sales, lies in the creation of styling that can accommodate these much larger sizes. To illustrate, let me offer the experience that I'm currently having in helping my daughter build her engagement ring. I asked her to visit stores in her local community to get a sense both of the size diamond, she happens to love ovals, and the look of the mounting that would be her dream ring. and I identified a specific store in her market that I know has an exceptional number of semi-mounts, and asked her to make sure to visit that one. At the end of her shopping trip, she came to a remarkable conclusion. "Dad," she said, "I tried on a lot of things, and it looks like anything over 2.5 carats is just too big for my fingers." What a remarkable thought, given the fact that I know there's nothing about her fingers that would prohibit a larger diamond. But then it occurred to me, the problem wasn't the way diamonds larger than 2.5 carats looked on her hand. The problem was the way they looked in the context of the semi-mount she was trying on. As you might expect, the stores she visited didn't really have much in the way of styling choices for 3 and 4 carat diamonds, because in general, very few stores outside of affluent areas in major metros are selling many diamonds in that size range. For me, this illuminates a key point. We as an industry desperately need to start designing rings and pendants that will hold these larger size diamonds, or a continuation of the decline in lab-grown diamond prices will create precisely the reduction in average unit retail that everyone fears. Think of the jewelry in Elizabeth Taylor's collection, or the jewelry that Audrey Hepburn wore to the 1962 Oscars. Think of what Tiffany and Harry Winston were selling to the ultra-affluent. What styling characteristics allowed them to produce such beautiful jewelry using massive diamonds that now, because of lab, will become accessible to a much wider swath of consumers? Those of us who can solve these challenges have a wonderful opportunity not just to grow the lab-grown diamond part of the business, because remember, the diamond jewelry luxury vertical isn't a zero-sum marketplace where every lab-grown diamond that sells does so by cannibalizing a mined diamond sales. By finding new ways of selling ever larger, ever more beautiful diamonds, we may even discover business models that allow the diamond jewelry category to ascend to greater heights than ever before. In summary, lab-grown diamonds have created a new set of retailing paradigms in the jewelry business, acting as a catalyst to produce an extraordinarily alien brave new world for the diamond trade. As with prior disruptions, participants who can properly harness the energy of this consumption wave will benefit from their capacity to understand it, while those who fail to anticipate its most important implications may miss out on a rapidly growing revenue stream. What's important to recognize is that lab is not mined. It doesn't follow the same rules, and it doesn't behave in the same ways. I hope these insights in this presentation will help you to navigate these uncharted waters more effectively and with greater, more nuanced understanding of this extraordinary new disruptor. Again, my name is George Prout on behalf of the Plum Club. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.